This podcast is a production of the South Australian Aviation Museum for History Month 2021. Subject, the Spitfire.
Thank you everyone for coming along. My name is Peter Ingman. I'm the chairman of the history group here at the Aviation Museum. And this is the second of our May history talks, and they're all on RAAF themes, it being the centenary of the RAAF this year. And of course today the Spitfire is one of the most famous aircraft ever to have flown, and there's an enormous amount of mythology and so forth associated with the machine. Originally, we'd planned to slot in this talk as a sort of this open cockpit format that the owner of the plane, Langdon Badger, has been running for a number of years with his two sons, who I welcome here today, Langdon Jr. and Magnus, both of whom are extremely knowledgeable about the aircraft itself. Langdon recovered it from New Guinea in the early 70s, restored it. It was on private display in their property for a couple of decades, and then it's been on display at this museum since the 1990s, I believe. A few years ago, I'm also an aviation author, and I agreed to a contract with this British publisher, Osprey, to write about the Australian Spitfires versus the Zeros over Darwin. And I signed the contract, and I thought, well, I suppose I better find out something about about the Spitfire. So attending one of Langdon's open cockpits, I've learnt an enormous amount about this very famous aircraft, so much so that it gave me the confidence to write the book that's done quite well. So what I'll do, I'll give a little bit of an overview of the aircraft, and in particular its Australian service, which was very, very controversial indeed. And then after about 20 minutes or so, we'll go out and have a close-up around the aircraft hosted by Langdon Jr. and Magnus, and the cockpits open up, and certainly to have a look inside there is something quite special. So some of you would have been at the talk about the ferry battle last week, and I was just checking my stats and everything this morning, and both the Battle and the Spitfire had their first flight within a week of each other in March 1936. So this was at a time when certainly all the fighters in the Royal Air Force were biplanes, when most of these things had wooden propellers and fabric-covered fuselages and wings. And so both of these aircraft were all metal. They had retractable undercarriages and so forth, and they were seen as this amazing futuristic kind of aircraft. Obviously, we know they both had the same power plant as well, the Merlin engine. Unfortunately, the career of the Battle was somewhat limited, and it eventually became a training aircraft here in Australia in particular. But the Spitfire went on to become one of the most famous aircraft of all time. History tells us that it played a big role in winning the Battle of Britain in 1940, and it was one of, I think, very, very few aircraft that was still in production at the end of the war, I think until about 1948. So with all that massive technological sort of increases we had over that period of a decade, it was entering service where there was biplanes and everything with it, and then it was still in production when there were jet fighters flying in the skies of Europe. So the two most extraordinary things about the Spitfire were probably its wing and its engine. And its wing was had this very famous elliptical shape that we'll see out there, and this meant that it was amazingly manoeuvrable, and it was truly a pilot's aircraft. And Langdon Senior has, in fact, he's a pilot himself, and he's flown one of these two-seater aircraft in the UK, and he just raves about the controls and what a beautiful plane it is to fly. And I understand that the wing was pretty much unchanged as the aircraft was developed, and it could even achieve Mach 0.9 in a dive, supposedly, in the latest versions, which is quite exceptional. And it's one of these accidents of history, because the wing was designed not to be this incredibly manoeuvrable thing, but just to be an efficient way of putting four machine guns in each wing. But that's another story. The other part of the aircraft, of course, was this engine, the Merlin engine. And as World War II aircraft sort of developed, they got heavier and heavier. So typically the manufacturer would strip down this U-boot prototype and achieve this amazing sort of speed in this lightweight aircraft, and then the customer, the Air Force, would sign up for however many hundred there were. But when the aircraft entered service, they realised, well, you need to have extra armour to protect the pilot and all sorts of things. So to give you an idea of how many increases there were in the Merlin engine, it proved to be this power plant that they can continually tinker with, get more and more power out of it, and this sort of matched as the Spitfire got heavier and heavier with more and more technology. So the original Mark I Spitfire that fought in the Battle of Britain, that had a Mark III Merlin engine, and that Spitfire had a wooden propeller, fabric-covered ailerons, by the time of the Mark V Spitfire was out here, it had a metal propeller with variable pitch. It had metal ailerons and it had extra pilot armour. There were all sorts of black boxes. There's an identification, friend or foe, little device in there. And I think the mark of the engine that's for these ones, it was Mark 42. So from 46. Or 46, I beg your pardon. Not, who does? So from 1940 to 1942, the Merlin engine had gone from Mark III to a Mark 46. So you can imagine all the tinkering and changes that there were in that. To start talking a little bit about the Spitfire out there and how they came to Australia. Famously, when Darwin was bombed in February 1942, embarrassingly, the RAAF didn't have any fighter planes of its own in Australia. And we'd really put all of our eggs in the Singapore basket, where Britain had said, well, we'll defend Singapore and then Australia will be safe. So, of course, Singapore fell on the 15th of February. 4 days later, Darwin was bombed. And panic stations. Luckily, the Americans were here and they had P-40s that defended Darwin in 1942, and also P-39s that largely defended Port Moresby and New Guinea. And they did a reasonably good job. But the problem with those two planes were they had a supercharger that only worked at lower altitudes. So they were quite fast and manoeuvrable up to about 15 or 20,000 feet. And then their performance fell away really, really dramatically. And as the Japanese realised this, they came over Port Moresby and Darwin at higher and higher altitudes. So these planes were busting their guts to climb up to intercept them, only for these lightweight Zeros to dive out of the sun. And at that altitude, it was quite easy work for the Japanese. So the Australians, being very close to the Royal Air Force, we had a lot of pilots on exchange with them. A lot of our Emporia training pilots were serving with them. We had a lot of communication with the Royal Air Force, and in, I think, April or May of 1942, in sort of like a very political sort of statement, the British Prime Minister Churchill said, we'll give you a wing of Spitfires to defend Darwin. And the Australians were like, fantastic, we'll show the Yanks how to really fight the Japanese. And by this time, the Mark V Spitfire was a really superb machine, and its supercharger was rated for high altitudes. So it was at home at high altitudes. It could, I think, get to about 34,000 feet, which in the Southwest Pacific was very, very high. And that was a couple thousand feet higher altitude than what the Zero could achieve. And also the supercharger meant that... hi there. The supercharger meant that it had all its best power and performance at that altitude. So it was totally at home. Now, this was great. The Australians were very confident that these things would really sweep the Japanese clear of Darwin and so forth, and we'd really show the Americans how a proper air force fought. Now, one of the problems was that the Spitfires were originally intended. We originally got about 300 of them, but I think the first 100 or so to equip a full wing of three squadrons, they were sent to us around mid-1942, but when they were off the west coast of Africa, there was some emergency in North Africa, I think, with Tobruk or something, and they were all offloaded and flown there. So eventually, by the time we did get our Spitfires, it had taken a long, long time, over 6 months of being on the ocean. And during that time, the two squadrons, there were two Australian squadrons, 452 and 457, and one British squadron, number 54. They had been fighting in Europe with their own Spitfires, and 452 Squadron in particular was very successful. It was the highest scoring squadron, and that was the one commanded by Richard Bungie, who many of us would know his history. And so there was this pool of really experienced pilots. Unfortunately, by the time the squadrons got here, a lot of the best pilots had left. And a lot of these guys had not flown for 6 months. They'd been on these boats and in embarkation depots. They'd been sitting around waiting for the Spitfires to get here. And it was just a long, long drawn-out process. By the time the Spitfires did get to Darwin at the start of 1943, at the end of the wet season, they replaced the P-40s that were still there, and they expected with the drier season that the Japanese would start coming. And unfortunately, the record of the Spitfires was not that great, and there's a few reasons for this. One of them I'll talk about is the fact that they had a beautiful armament of two 20mm cannon and some machine guns, and these would have ripped into the Japanese planes and bombers in particular, which were really lightly built. But often when the pilots went to fire these guns, they just didn't work. And we think one of the reasons for this is that in Britain, when the Spitfires were in service, all the engineering facilities were very close, and the factory would, if there was a problem, they'd react straight away and they'd send little update kits and so forth to fix this. So when the Spitfires were at very high altitude, there was a chance that and they were there for some time, that the grease that lubricated the gun mechanisms would freeze up. And in Europe, they'd first equipped the wings of the planes with these little aluminium pipes that would get the gases from the engine, and they would vent into the wing of the plane and keep the guns warm. But it seemed like there was quite several sort of goes at getting this right, because the aluminium ones would crack after they had sort of frozen and then come down to ground and then gone up again and so forth. And so they replaced them with steel ones. And I think, as Magnus said, there was some talk about they had to use a special type of lubricating grease and so forth that was less prone to freezing. The problem is, in Europe, there was probably a lot of, with the engineering facilities being very close to the squadrons themselves, you know, the engineering officer would just chat to the manufacturing people from the factory, and they'd get the update changed over and then change it again if need be. But by the time these planes had come out to Australia, 6 months by boat, they were all from different batches. Some of them didn't have any gun heating mechanisms at all, apparently, and whether they thought in the tropical conditions they just wouldn't be needed. Others had variations of all the different upgrades, and it took quite a while for them to work out what was going on. So a weapons platform is not very effective if the armament is not reliable, and that was certainly the case for the Spitfires in the first few months of fighting. One of the other problems was if one of the cannons didn't work, you'd fire the other one, and then the aircraft would sort of yaw around. So they couldn't. It was impossible to aim one cannon by itself very accurately. So that was one of the issues they had. Another issue they had was range, and the Spitfire was really designed as a point interceptor over, you know, southeast England. It's not a huge area. They detect the German bombers coming over. These things would zoom up, intercept the bombers, then go and land and refuel and get ready to do again. In the Pacific, you needed a lot of range, and this was something the Japanese aircraft had extremely effectively. And the Spitfires, they used drop tanks, but for various reasons, they just didn't have the legs needed. And probably the plane they really needed was something like the twin-engine Lightning, which the Americans ended up using in 1943. Combined with that lack of range, the Australian commander in charge of Number One Fighter Wing, Wing Commander Clive Caldwell, who was famously a highest-scoring ace and the highest-scoring P-40 pilot of any nationality in the war, he was quite a brilliant individualistic pilot, but he was not so great tactically, although that's how history has judged him. So before coming out here, he'd actually had some experience in Europe, I think, in Kenley, and he'd been educated in these big wing tactics, which is the idea that where you have a big enemy and you have a defence of a similar size, rather than just attacking in so-called penny packets that might be overwhelmed by the enemy, you sort of save up, get everything ready, and then just attack it with sort of one blow. And that's the theory, and it's quite nice. But the problem with Darwin is, and there was one squadron base in Darwin, another two at Strauss and Livingston, which were about 30 or 40 kilometres south. And so these planes had to use a lot of time and fuel to form up as one wing before going into battle. And this famously vindicated itself in one of the first big engagements where 14 of the, I think, 38 Spitfires were lost or crash-landed, and a lot of those just ran out of fuel because they spent so much time forming up to do this perfect sort of formation tactic against the Japanese that after they'd done their battle, and the pilots at that stage weren't that familiar with the territory, a lot of them just ran out of fuel. One of the other things was the American pilots executed these so-called dive and zoom tactics, whereby their heavier fighters would do one pass through the Japanese and then they would just get out of there, because it was sort of very, very bad idea to dogfight with the Zeros, which was much lighter and could climb much, much, much faster. And when the Spitfire pilots started doing this, they actually, because they could go much higher up, they started doing these dives almost vertically, where they were going so fast, they'd go straight through the Japanese formation, spray their bullets everywhere if in fact the armament was working. And then they'd sort of come back up, and then because they knew the Spitfire was such a manoeuvrable plane, they sort of got sucked into dogfighting with the Japanese, which wasn't such a great idea. So that was sort of some of the main reasons why this beautiful interceptor, which should have worked really, really well, it just had some teething troubles in the first few months of 1943, and so it didn't really achieve the record it should have. But I think if the Japanese virtually packed up and went home after that air campaign in the 1943 dry season. So if it had been fought again in 1944, I think a lot of these teething problems would have been sorted out, and the Spitfire would have performed a lot better. Aside from one fighter wing, there are only two other units that use the Mark V Spitfire that's out there, and that was 79 Squadron, which was a unit that particular Spitfire was flying with when it crashed in New Guinea, I think in a landing or takeoff accident. And that was at a place called Goodenough Island off the eastern tip of New Guinea, and it was about 400 miles from Rabaul. But by that stage, the Japanese weren't doing a lot of offensive air operations, and I think they might have had some fleeting contact with Japanese reconnaissance planes and stuff like that, but certainly no heated air battles. And then there was a squadron at Perth as well that flew them until the end of the war, but obviously didn't see any Japanese activity. But I've probably spoken just about long enough. I suggest we go out there and maybe break into a couple of groups, and feel free to ask me some questions and discussions. In fact, does anyone have any questions before we move out? No. All right. Well, let's get out there, and certainly Magnus and Langdon can show people through the cockpit. I understand the instruction is not to touch the aircraft because the oils in our skin can corrode the paint and so forth on the aircraft. So enjoy, but don't touch. Thanks for listening. 2 seconds.